From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. If you want more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, then please visit us at stateofbelief.com.
A recent spike in anti-gay violence in New York City.
Yelling at them, calling them gay slurs.
Saturday's shooting death of a man as he walked with his male companion.
Two more hate crime attacks.
A rally and march on Monday drew thousands to restore a sense of safety. But hours later, there were two more anti-gay attacks.
June is traditionally observed across the country as Gay Pride Month. Sadly, this year, the month begins with the LGBT community reeling from a recent surge in anti-gay violence and even murder in a place that's long been seen as a safe haven for sexual minorities. On this week's show, we'll look at what's been happening and the possible role for organized religion in these tragic events with Pastor Joseph Tolton, a leader in New York City's gay Christian community.
Muslim religious leaders from the Middle East, U.S., Africa, and Europe have joined Jewish scholars and rabbis on a visit to a former Nazi concentration camp.
One imam exclaimed, "My people don't know what happened here." Press coverage of this historic trip highlighted those words from Dr. Ahmet Otley. On this week's show, we'll speak to him from Istanbul, Turkey. But first, on May the 22nd, the global head of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, made a statement that reverberated around the world.
The Pope said, "The Lord redeemed all of us, not just Catholics with the blood of Christ, everyone, even atheists."
In religious circles, many predicted the Vatican wouldn't let the message stand, and they were right. Days later, some of the more provocative headlines blared, quote, "Vatican corrects infallible Pope, atheist will still burn in hell." Theologically, the heaven question is an intriguing one. Even more intriguing is what's going on in Rome. With me to discuss these matters is Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, who's been kept quite busy by the steady stream of news coming out of the Vatican. Kevin, welcome back to State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Is this a big story?
It is and it isn't. On the yes, it is a big story question, you have a pope who comes out and very informally says, well, actually, yeah, atheists are saved by the sacrifice of Jesus. And the pope had two audiences when he was talking to this. He was primarily talking to Catholics, which is what he typically does. But he also has an eye on the wider world. And so what he was telling Catholics is it's more than just the church, that Christ did not die for Catholics alone, that Christ died for everyone. He died for Lutherans and Baptists and Muslims and even atheists, even unbelievers. And he used this sort of rhetorical tool where he sort of pretended to ask himself. He's like, well, what about atheists? Are they saved too? And he said, yes, absolutely. So what he was really doing there was talking to the church and saying, in a way, get over yourself. It's not all about you. It's not just about Catholics, that the salvation that God offers is wider than just us. What he was doing there was sending a signal to atheists that there are some things that they can agree on, and there are things that they can work for and that they should work for and that God actually demands that they work for together. And in his mind, it's charity. So doing good works. And so he was telling the wider world that Catholics can and should work with others, including non-believers, in doing good. Now, is this a revolutionary statement from the Pope? In content, no, but in how he said it, yes.
Why not in content? Because, some of the predecessors have identified the Catholic Church as the only really acceptable people to God.
Well, that's right. And so in that sense, it is big. What he is saying is that it's not just Catholics. In the history of the church is fairly revolutionary. The question, though, is this, you know, authoritative papal teaching, or is this the Pope giving a morning mass off the cuff? Well, it's more him speaking extemporaneously off the cuff. It's not an infallible teaching because that's a certain type of teaching, and this wasn't it. But yeah, it's remarkable not only for what he said, but how he said it and how casual it was.
I mean, I understand that for this to have authority, it has to go through all of the processes that establish a level of doctrine for the congregation. Right. But it has within his statement, it has the seeds of universalism.
It does.
Over against a doctrine that is more exclusive than it is inclusive. Mm-hmm. And it's what makes me think that even if he was talking off the cuff, we might have gotten a glimpse into his heart and mind that is different from his creedal obligations.
Right. And so the most interesting thing about this pope, there's lots of things, but one of the most interesting things to me is how he is trying to redirect the church, redirect the papacy, redirect the clergy from always looking internally to worrying about priests who want to climb the ladder and become bishops, Catholics who only care about how the mass is celebrated, Catholics who are obsessed with who gets into heaven and who doesn't. And what he's trying to do is turn the focus of the church externally and saying, it's not just about us, it's about all of humanity, and that the salvation that Christ brought into the world isn't just for us. It's not just for us guys in pointy hats. Mm-hmm. It's not just for clergy. It's for everyone. Now, here's where the Vatican stepped in and tried to rein him back a little bit. And they said that what he is saying is, in fact, sort of standard church teaching that Christ died for all. Now, that does not mean that all are going to get into heaven. That means basically that the offer of salvation is there. Whether a person chooses to accept it is ultimately what determines whether or not you get into heaven. But even broadening the scope like that by saying that the offer is available to all takers is, in the history of Rome and of the papacy, pretty revolutionary.
How unique was it for the Vatican to step in and correct what the Pope said?
So here's the thing. The Pope does Mass every day at the residence where he lives. He doesn't necessarily do it at St. Peter's Basilica or in the square. He does it every day in this small chapel. And he has been very clear with the Vatican that he wants to say what he wants, how he wants, and he's not going to use a prepared text. And he speaks from the heart, basically. So when you have a pope who stands up at the pulpit and delivers an address, you can kind of control what he says because those speeches and sermons are often written for the pope. This pope has come in and said, no, I'm going to say what I want. And the Vatican has said, we will release excerpts of these morning sermons every day to let you know what he's saying, but they're not going to make them official transcripts because then they would actually have to go and correct these things and whatnot. So this is a more freewheeling pope than they've been used to, but that's exactly what he wants to be.
In the hierarchy, who gets to correct the Pope?
Well, technically nobody. But when it comes to stuff like this, it's the media office.
Yeah.
The folks who put together his remarks and release them.
Yeah. This isn't the only time he's caused some ruffles in what usually are very planned, smooth waters. He's broken with recent and even ancient tradition. We saw some of them during the Easter season. We saw some during Holy Week. Are there others of these incidents that stand out as particularly newsworthy?
I think really it's more a change in style as opposed to substance, although this particular address on salvation was pretty substantive. But, you know, little things like he lives in the Vatican Hotel, basically, as opposed to the papal apartments. They released a letter that he wrote to a friend in Argentina, and he said, it helps keep me grounded. It helps keep me not isolated. That in itself is a fairly revolutionary statement for the papacy, because the papacy was always this elevated office, and, you know, the person in the chair could basically do no wrong. Mm-hmm. And he's really bringing the papacy back down to earth, which, yeah, it's a style thing, but it's also a substance thing, because it's really about, what is the church about? What is the Pope about? And what does the Pope have to say to people? He wears his old plain cross around his neck that he wore in Argentina. He wears the black shoes instead of the red loafers. But they point to a larger idea of what the Pope should be. Mm-hmm. And this is a much more low-key, humble, approachable type of Pope than the church has ever really had.
Well, and I think the results of that are pretty clear, that both Catholics and non-Catholics who've been critical of the church are inspired and feel hope about some change taking place in the whole structure of the Vatican and of the Catholic Church. But really, I mean, how much leeway does he have? I mean, here they come back and correct this statement. Doesn't he live in a fairly rigid structure?
He does. And so, yeah, there are some limits as to what he could come out and say. So the Pope can never speak against the doctrine of the church. So he could never come out and say, for example, just being a good person is going to get you into heaven. That's not going to square. He's now going to come out and say, well, Jesus wasn't truly divine. I mean, he is constrained by the theological limits of the church, and he is constrained by the expectations of the papacy. Now, that being said, there are things that he could do that would be completely revolutionary, that basically he could make happen. He could open the priesthood to married clergy, for example. Mm-hmm. He could change the rules on who can receive communion, you know, could divorce Catholics. He could put women in leadership roles in the church. Now, he's probably not going to be able to come out and say that women can be priests, because that is a theological understanding for the church. But he can change how the church operates, which is actually very important, but also, more importantly, how the church understands itself. And that, as we saw with Vatican II in the 1960s, can be a total game changer.
Yeah.
And sometimes it takes Vatican II or Vatican I. Sometimes all it takes is a fairly charismatic pope.
Do you see that level of change coming?
I think the potential is there. Yeah. Now, he is up against some fairly established forces, historical. He's got a huge bureaucracy underneath him that is very reluctant to change. Yeah. He's got to come out and explain to 1.2 billion people around the world what a change would be and why he can make it. But I think the capacity and the kind of character that it would take to bring major change to the church is what we're seeing in this pope.
Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief of the award-winning Religion News Service. The website is www.religionnews.com. Kevin, as always, I thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. The conversations are among the best we have. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It's time for a break. But still to come on this week's show, one of the imams that participated last month in a groundbreaking trip to Holocaust sites in Europe. And up next, I'll talk to Pastor Joseph Tolton about the surge in anti-gay violence in New York City and the role of organized religion in these tragic events. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Since the beginning of this year, anti-gay hate crimes in famously tolerant and diverse New York City have almost doubled since last year. They include the cold-blooded slaying of a 32-year-old gay man and attacks that have happened in broad daylight. Joining me now is Elder Joseph Tolton, pastor of Rehoboth Temple Christ Conscious Church in New York City. Joseph, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate you asking me to be your guest today.
despite the marches protesting the violence, despite promises of increased police presence, the attacks have continued. I know there were reports of a man being called a slur and slapped on a Midtown street just a few days ago, and other incidents since the tragic shooting of Mark Carson just a few blocks from what's considered to be the birthplace of the modern gay rights movement. In your opinion, where is this violence coming from?
I deeply believe that at its core, what's really driving these attacks is that the perception and definition and understanding of what it means to be a man and what masculinity is all about is now being challenged in an incredible way. I think that with Jason Collins coming out as the first professional athlete to come out and state that he was gay, and I do think that it's important that he was a man of color who came out mm-hmm. and that he was a basketball player, which of course is dominated by black men. And he has performed very well as a basketball player. And so now you have a crop of young men, particularly youth of color, who are not particularly well educated, socially disenfranchised, they don't have a lot of political power. And for them, their sense of authority and power and belonging in the world has always been predicated on this notion that they defined and embodied masculinity. Now that it is clear that that is not the case anymore, and that by Jason Collins coming out, he's really kind of single-handedly deconstructed that myth, yeah. I think that you now have these young men who are frightened because they don't have a particular future. They're frightened because their hold on masculinity, which drove their identity, is now being taken away from them. And so now these violent attacks is a result of their lashing out because now they are completely afraid. They have to redefine what it means now to be a man. And I think that that's very threatening.
Is that why you said that it was important or significant to recognize that he was a man of color?
I think that it is extremely important to recognize that he was a man of color. For many years, the idea of being gay was associated with whiteness, and mm-hmm. oftentimes, particularly black gay men, would be accused of being gay because of our association with white people. But as President Obama affirmed marriage equality in May of 2012, it really began to shift perceptions within the African-American community. And you've got people like Jay-Z and other stalwarts of the black community who have come out in support of LGBT people. And then with Jason Collins, yes, importantly, an African-American man coming out and being very clear about his sexual orientation, mm-hmm. but at the same time also being very clear about his own sense of machismo, I think it is absolutely important and relevant that as a man of color, he is now challenged other men of color around what does it really mean to be a man? That is the real question that I believe these young men are asking themselves, mm-hmm. and they are coming up short in their answer. And it is because of their coming up short that they are now lashing out.
It's time for a quick break, but I'll have more with Pastor Joseph Tolton in just a minute. Still to come on this week's show, one of the imams that participated last month in a groundbreaking trip to Holocaust sites in Europe. Now, just a reminder, there will be more of this conversation as well as all of the interviews on this week's show available online at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Pastor Joseph Tolton, who leads the Rehoboth Temple Christ Conscious Church in New York City. Joseph, you and I both know that LGBT persons have been used as pawns in the culture wars for a long time by the religious right with all kinds of hateful rhetoric. Does this play into this situation as well? Is there a connection there?
Oh, I think that there absolutely is a connection. Given the fact that the wedge issue no longer works, broadly speaking, and it certainly no longer works in the African American community. I think that what that speaks to is a certain level of acceptance that our community has come to. And I think that oftentimes people in our community, we celebrate the fact that we have opened up so many doors and that equality seems to be, you know, raining like a hurricane. But what we have not asked ourselves is, what was driving all of this resistance in the first place? And so now there's an opportunity for us to have that conversation. What was really driving all of the hostility in the first place?
What responsibility do religious leaders in particular have for creating or helping to create an atmosphere where anti-gay violence seems to be okay? Because even the death of one gay man hasn't seemed to shock anyone into coming to their senses.
You are absolutely right. Religious leaders have a huge role to play here. When President Obama affirmed marriage equality, I can tell you that there were preachers, particularly obviously conservative preachers, and I'm now going to talk about preachers of color, who made it a point of preaching incredibly vitriolic sermons against marriage equality. And I do think that their rhetorical backlash against President Obama and against the greater acceptance in our community definitely incensed people who are unlearned and ignorant. And I do think that the church has a real vital role to play here, and that the church must stand up. And even if you do not affirm the full dignity of LGBT people as it relates to our spiritual reconciliation, you must stand up and say that God is not a God that justifies violence, and that it is a sin to create these kinds of acts. The church has a real role to play here.
When you're talking with your colleagues in New York City, what's the conversation like? What are you saying to each other?
When I talk to my more conservative colleagues, they're very hands-off. This is not our issue. These are not people from our community. This is not an issue that we can touch. And the reason that they're afraid of speaking out against gay violence is that they perceive that if they speak out against gay violence, that somehow there is a subtle message that they're actually pro-gay. And it's more important to them to have a clear position of being anti-gay than it is for them to actually stand up and do the right thing and be counted. And I think that that's really unfortunate. When I talk to my more liberal and progressive friends, of course, they are outraged and horrified, and I think that you will see a very, very strong faith-based response coming from progressive people of faith right here in New York City. I know that Judson Memorial Church is actually bringing together faith leaders so that we can ideate and strategize on what is a best way for us to use our pulpits and to use our theology and to use the networks of our congregations to push back and to create messages of tolerance.
Have you seen a noticeable change in how LGBT people are going about their daily lives in the city since all this started? Is there a sense of fear or sadness or some other kind of change you've noticed?
There is a real sense of sadness. There is a real sense of, we were just popping the champagne corks. We were just celebrating, and here now we are faced with this crisis. And so I think that there is a real sense of sadness, and I have to say that people are actually really shocked by this, in that we did not anticipate this. And I think it's unfortunate that we didn't anticipate this, because this is a very natural reaction to the progress that we have made. It's the reaction that happened as it relates to President Obama being the first African-American who was elected president. There was a natural kind of response from people who had some racist sentiment. So I think we should not be surprised by this. And I think that we've got to be encouraged that this is only happening because we have achieved the victories that we have. And we are an incredibly strong community. God is on our side, and victory will ultimately be ours. We will prevail and get through this very difficult period.
If we were going to contextualize what we're seeing in New York in the broader world, and also in the sweep of history, what words would you use to try to do that?
It's a wonderful question. I think that we are on the precipice of tremendous, tremendous change. I think that here in the West, we are moving from tolerance to inclusion and to being fully embraced, totally affirmed, and completely understood. And now we are experiencing the last of what would be the lion roaring the loudest before he is to be slayed. I think that as we make that progress in the West, that in other parts of the world, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, particularly places like Africa and even in Eastern Europe, that they are actually moving to a place of tolerance. So as we evolve from being tolerated to being embraced and accepted, they are moving from being rejected to having conversations about what does it mean for them to be tolerated. So there is an interesting arc that is definitely moving, and our movement here in the United States is completely connected to the movement in Uganda, which is connected to the movement in Russia, and we are all moving, and there's a domino effect that is happening, but the arc of history is absolutely bending toward justice.
Elder Joseph Tolton is pastor of Rehoboth Temple Christ Conscious Church in New York City. He's the director of the Revival Initiative, a spiritual forum purposed to advance the civil rights of gay and lesbian people in the African diaspora. Joseph, it's a heartbreaking time in some ways, and yet listening to you, I felt inspiration and encouragement, and I just feel so fortunate to be able to call on you to talk about it, and I wish you all the best in your important ministry. Stay safe and keep up the good work.
God bless you, Welton. It's always a joy to be in conversation with you, and I appreciate you and the wonderful work that you do, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you yet again.
We've got to take another quick break, and then I'll be joined by Dr. Ahmet Muharrem Atlig, one of the imams who traveled to Nazi concentration camps last month to pray for Holocaust victims. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I hope you had a chance to see the moving photographs that were widely published this past week of a group of Muslim leaders from around the globe who traveled together to the sites of Nazi death camps, prayed for Holocaust victims, and met with survivors. When we talk about interfaith action, this is interfaith action at its best and its most holy. Joining me right now to talk about this trip and what it meant to him is Dr. Ahmet Atlig. We've reached him at his home in that beautiful city of Istanbul, Turkey. Imam Atlig, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Welcome.
Talk first about this incredible trip, how it came together, and how you came to be a part of it.
I was an imam of a Turkish community, firstly in Houston, Texas, for 3 years. Then I moved to London, and then I served as an imam of Turkish community in Southwark, south part of London, for 5 years. Because of this experience, I think, I have been invited to that incredible trip.
Tell us some of the things that the group was able to do on this trip.
First of all, the group includes intellectuals, imams, the religious people, Islamic scholars. They are coming all from the religious background. Mm-hmm. And then very well-known people in their society. For most of them, was the first time to see the Holocaust site. Mm. For all of us, this trip was the turning point in our spiritual life. Hmm. Because we read many things about Holocaust and then the murderer and SS history and Nazi's history. Many people who come from religious background, theology background, easily can learn and read literatures about the Holocaust. This trip told us the knowing something and digesting or internalizing something is really different.
Mm-hmm.
We have been transformed, I can say.
What was the significance of that transformation that took place in you?
I like to give an example from my personal decision. I have three boys, 17, 10, and 2 years old. Before the trip, I was thinking, like every mother and father, you know, making some future plans about my boy.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I want my boys be a doctor, be a pilot, be an architecture or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was very important for me, for everybody, you know. But when I saw the situation over there, imagine we saw the survivors. And then they came from all over around the Poland and Munich or something, the German, by the train in very bad condition. And directly they gone to the gas chamber, from the small children to the elderly people. And then very, very planned murder, very technological murder we saw. And then we really scared. We really scared that these murderers are not barbers. These murderers were very educated people. They were listening Beethoven. They were picturing. They were as in hobbies, you know, the modern people hobbies. And then they were almost intellectuals in their society. They were not uneducated, arrogant people. When I figured out the situation, I started to think about that, oh, it could be done in near future. I mean, tomorrow somebody can come and do something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then to know this, it is very scary.
Yeah.
After thinking all of things, I made a decision about my boy. I said to them when I came back to my country, okay, I am not interested in what you're gonna be in the future, be a doctor, architecture, or anything. Doesn't matter for me. I am interested in that you're gonna be a human first.
Hmm.
If you be a human, I am satisfied about it.
Hmm.
Because I understood that we need human.
Yes, yes.
First.
Some people look at two different faith traditions or three different faith traditions, and they conclude that they are so different that they use the differences as powerful weapons in driving people apart. What was it in you, in your tradition, that responded so understandingly and compassionately to what you found there?
Actually, I'm coming from Izmir, Smyrna, the biblical name is.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody knows in Turkey and around, Izmir, my hometown, is very well known as a Jewish place.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, right after the establishing the Republic of Turkey, unfortunately, we lost the diversity and the relationship between different culture and religion. And I was a fruit of, unfortunately, from that area. I grew up without any Jewish friend, without any Christian friend, without any different denomination. I'm coming from very radical Islamic background.
Mm-hmm.
But when I graduated from the university, I met a person, my spiritual leader. He was at the same time the very well-known Islamic scholar in Turkey. When I met him and I expressed my future plans to him, at the end of the conversation, he said, "Oh, brother, no offense, but you have many dangerous ideas about the future of the world." I said, "Why?" He said that you are coming from just one group of people. You are not coming from the diversity. This is very flammable. This is very dangerous. And then I asked, okay, what is your recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said that you have to go abroad. For example, the United States or any other country.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to taste the others. This is very important. Because when you taste the others, you're going to understand that you are human first.
Hmm.
Then you are Muslim, or then you are Christian, or then you are Jewish. Doesn't matter. And then I did.
Yes.
I went to the United States, and then I lived there for 3 years. Imagine, I'm coming from the very Islamic background, and then I directly went to the Christian society and then Christian seminary.
Right.
There was a turning point. Imagine me. I was only one imam in Christian seminary. Around me, everybody was priests.
Mm-hmm.
I was very alone at that time.
Right.
And then my father passed away. And I was crying at the corner of the seminary. The professor, at the same time, he was the dean of the seminary, Professor Father Nesty, came to me and said, "Oh, Ahmed, why are you crying?" I said, "My father passed away." And then he started right away, he started to cry with me. 15, 20 minutes, we cried by hugging each other. And then I understood that we are human.
Right.
And then he's Christian, but he's crying for my father, for my situation.
Yeah.
And then I hugged him, he hugged me, and then I know at that time I have been transformed.
Yes. Let me ask you, at the end of the pilgrimage, the group of imams that went issued a statement. What was the essence of that statement?
The essence of the statement is, we have been isolated. We don't know each other. That means we don't share our problems. If we live side by side, or if we understood each other, then we're going to share each other in our problems. Because the Holocaust site is not for Jewish people. Holocaust site is world heritage. And everybody must go and see the place for future of the world. The Muslim people, especially Muslim people, have to go and see that kind of places in order to express these situations to their congregation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ahmed Alig has served as an imam in London and currently is Secretary General of the Journalist and Writers Foundation Platform for Intercultural Dialogue. He was one of the group of Muslim leaders from around the world who traveled to former Nazi death camps to pray for Holocaust victims. We reached him in Istanbul, Turkey. Dr. Alig, I can't thank you enough for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
I thank you for this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners just like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely, I promise you that. To keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about this show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. I hope you will share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information, if you need it, is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. We also encourage you to tell other people about this program and encourage them to listen to it also. Our hope is to be a part of a conversation that reaches all across our nation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. By all means, join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. Yes, he was.